spend just a little bit of time talking about no plug, no play, no worship, the role of technology in contemporary worship. This is the topic where I'm actually seeing the widest divergence of practices right now, and where I think the most striking changes have occurred in the last 15 years. Most people's attention is still drawn to the music and the composers and that sort of thing, but it's the technological advances that, if you take a step back, they're actually the kind of the more radical ones in a way. So I hope this is not a little bit of an overstatement. I've just been wondering if this is the most electronically dependent form of Christian worship ever. The technological dependence came early. We've seen this book before. This is just an example. One of the things that came out of that experimentation in the 1960s was the desire to do things with technology. Here's a great quote from Jim White here. And what he articulated, this is 1967, I still see replicated. And this is gap thinking, if you remember the gift gap divide. People are here, church is here, so to help bridge the gap, we need to use electronic technology. As I'm talking to the AV consultants and the sales representatives, they use the same sort of thinking. People are used to a certain level of quality of sight and sound in their own home entertainment systems. So why should they go to church and take a step back in terms of sight and sound? It's a very common thing, I guess. We already saw this clip, but remember how kind of unplugged much of the early worship was, and even some of the stories we got in here, the multiple youth groups meeting in the park and singing. Okay. And then some pictures. Early worship. Now, this is the simple one for me. These are some of my closest friends from 1982. This is the campus ministry I got converted in.
Wow. Okay.
And a little background story. This was my college girlfriend. And the only guitar I've ever bought in my entire life, I bought as a present for her. There's the guitar. So this picture's in the book. For the longest time, I kept thinking, how come I'm not in the picture? I had multiple, because the whoever's taking the camera moved around the room, took different shots. I was like, where am I? Because I went to all of these meetings. This is the Wesley Foundation at Stephen F. Austin State University, Nacogdoches, Texas. Go Jacks! Chop, 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 chop. Anyway, sorry. The illegal songbook that they're singing from, I helped to type up. So I have a picture. I bought the guitar. I typed up illegally the songbook. And I have, back in April, I got to meet Kirk Kaiser.
Wow.
And I was telling him that I had probably illegally typed up his song and put it in the song and pass it on. And he responded, well, that's okay, because I just took one of your books from the book table. This is a great cover. This is the front cover from Bob Sorge's book, 1985, 1986, I think it is. And I'm just struck. I'm struck by how they're dressed. I'm struck by how having a vocal team rather than a choir, what that's done in terms of the improvisation and the space. Because I'm assuming this is a choir loft right back there. Don't you think?
Yeah.
So this whole adaptation, and I'm also struck by how many things are unplugged here. How little electricity is required. And what I think has been a permanent step back in the quality of all contemporary worship music, the absence of the tambourine. Okay? Since this is one of the few musical instruments I can actually do anything with. I'm all over contemporary worship without a kind of tambourine. This is a United Methodist youth service in 1971.
But it's a Hammond organ.
So this is real contemporary worship because there is a
tambourine.
That's wrong. But so there, I mean, this is laying. I look at this picture and I see some of the scenes for the need for electricity. Okay, because you gotta have it here. You gotta have it here. You gotta have it here. You gotta have it in. And surely there's some monitor someplace. Well, I mean, you know, so the electronic dependency based on the particular instrumentation and kind of formation. Don't you love this picture?
Yeah.
Okay, and so this is old Willow Creek. Okay, so this is Willow Creek, 1990s. And, you know, when I look at it from a technological eye, I see some things. I mean, there's some stage lighting. You get the large image magnification. But if you've been to Willow Creek, they're old space. The thing that was quite striking was these clear glass windows. Okay, who wants large clear glass windows anymore if you're trying to do...
Well, they had electronic blinds.
Blinds that went up and down was electronic.
Okay, now this is the picture of Willow Creek from the most recent edition of Church Production Magazine.
Can you say Hillsong?
So there's been a change.
Same stage.
Really, I'm sorry?
Same stage,
yeah.
No, it's completely different.
Is it a completely different building?
Yep. A new building.
Yeah, okay. I noticed the major light source is a natural one here. But not here, so I was just really struck by that. I'm showing lots of pictures because it's very late. You're already talking. This is a wonderful ad I saw in Charisma magazine from a February 1985 issue. And, you know, so kind of first forays into more standard. So notice the screen here. And in fact, this is a company that's selling pre-developed slides, both for the overhead projector and for the old slide projectors. And some of y'all will remember that. You know, and I just love it. You look at the older material, and they have to explain why this would be good. It frees the hands of the congregation of books. And just the sense of the novelty of that, that you could be at worship where you don't have to hold anything. I mean, that's just second nature to us now. But even just 30 years ago, it's like, wow, that's really different. I got asked to write a scholarly essay once, essentially on the topic, why early Methodists didn't really want to be Anglican. It's in the handbook for Methodist studies. And I just started thinking about it. If you got to hold a Book of Common Prayer, you can't clap. If you got to hold a Book of Common Prayer, you can't raise your hand. Both of which were standard Methodist worship practices 250 years ago. If you're holding a book of prayers, it's hard to fall down, run, jump. In other words, the book in the hand domesticates worship because it puts a tether on how strong the emotion can be or how strong the ecstasy can be. So you free up the hands, and all of a sudden your whole human person becomes a potential percussive instrument, which I think is integral to the whole contemporary worship thing. This is an early adopting Lutheran church in Houston, 1996. And just in case there was anyone in here who didn't remember what an overhead projector was. I read the most interesting article. This may be the first instance in which Christian worship has ever been dependent upon bowling alleys. And from bowling alleys to classrooms, the church sanctuaries, the evolution of these things. This is another great example here. Oh, notice percussive instrument. Percussive instrument. This is the pastor of the church. And again, in many early adopting things, oftentimes the pastor... usually himself, has musical skills. And is there something about having the pastor kind of helping to lead the music? I think makes it more tolerable or acceptable to these folks. Early on, there were churches that really began, their niche market was advancing the technological aspects. So this is, these are all, this is all literature from the United Methodist Church, Ginghamsburg United Methodist Church, up in Tipp City, Ohio, up on the north side of Dayton. Anybody ever been to their conferences or read their books? Kim Miller is their creative pastor. Mike Slaughter's the preaching pastor.
He just retired this week.
Oh, did he really?
Yeah.
This week?
Yeah.
Wow. And then Lynn Wilson was kind of an early computer graphics guy. These books all date from mid to late 90s. And this church is funny because, I mean, the way they portray it is they built a new building in 1994 and decided to build in all of the technological bells and whistles, even though they didn't know how to use it. So they got all the toys first, and then they figured out what to do with them. The accuracy of that reminiscing, I'm not real sure. I've actually interviewed Kim Miller within the last year and a half, and that's the way she still portrayed it, or 2.5 years. And that's the way she still portrayed it. And there's just something that doesn't strike me. I mean, once you start investing large sums of money, usually you want a little bit more information and intentionality up front. So I'm not calling them untrue. I'm quite right.
Do you have any notion or facts or figures as to when they went from some of the churches doing music and words on the screen to just words?
No, I don't.
Okay.
Do you?
Late 90s, that was what I remember.
Yeah.
Some of the churches were still asking for the music on the screen rather than just the words, and I almost got fired just putting the words on. So.
Oh, is that right? And, you know, Bob Weber used to have a standard answer when he didn't really know. Somebody would ask Bob, when did something change in worship? And Bob would always say, 6th century. I mean, that was his answer. You know, because everybody was know all that about the 6th century. So he could just throw it out and no one would disagree with him. So when it comes to all the technology stuff, my tendency is to call me 98 to 2000. Because generally when I look pre-98, there's kind of one state of the question in terms of technology. And when I look post-2000, there's a different state of the question technologically.
That makes sense.
You know, and even like this little anecdote that you just told me, like, yeah, right, kind of right there.
Yeah.
And the two books I'm about to show you now, both of these are right on the bubble of that pre-98 period. I think this one, these are Disciples of Christ, Early Adopters. This is a Chalice Press resource. So you're thinking about contemporary worship. So this is how you do contemporary worship if you're Disciples of Christ Restoration Movement. And it's interesting, isn't it? They have to have a section about, is this the one? No, this is not even the one. I even have a book from the same period of like, microphones or no microphones? Mm-hmm. You know. So they're debating overhead projector or computer projector. But you can go either way, you know. And in fact, some of y'all will recognize Barry Leash here. His book, same time period. Barry's quite sure what you need are two slide projectors. This is his standard thing that he's advocating. You want one slide projector, project lyrics. Second slide projector, project nature scene. Yeah, and the fact that this comes out in the mid-90s, you get to 98 to 2000, nobody's
going
to do that anymore. Nobody's going to do that. This is actually a very early adopter of the technology. This is perhaps the church that first used image magnification and built it into the space. So I mean, you can see, they, 1985, where is Lakeland, Florida?
Near Orlando.
Okay. I forget the particular story. They had seen this done in some other setting. I think it was a secular conference, a large conference, and they'd say, man, that's way cool, and we can sit far away, and we could still see the face of the speaker. So when they built the space, they built in the screens right here. Again, now this is so standard. What I'm finding, in the 90s, so even starting in the early 90s, I start seeing evidence of this is the new development, and part of this, or a new awareness, and part of this is the creation of magazines. And so I've been unable to find anyone yet who has the back issues all the way back into the 90s. So Church Production is the second of the two magazines, and the first one is Technology and Ministry Magazine. I think if any of y'all are hoarders of old issues of Technology and Ministry Magazine, I would love to talk to you. But these are not old editions, but this is Church Production, and this is a more recent magazine that's come about, Church Design. And in fact, Willow Creek's new multi-site campus, so that must be a Willow Creek building back there.
And PowerPoint made a whole different thing, too.
Yeah.
So that until then, we were doing, you know, overhead projectors. In fact, our campus ministry was doing two overhead projectors, one for the students who were worshiping and one in the back for the worship team.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So...
Oh, is that right? You know, and the overhead projector allows some flexibility that either the slide projector or computer graphics has not.
Right.
Now, it drove whoever had the transparencies crazy because they'd have to flip through them real quick and find the right one and put
exactly.
it up there. But so my campus ministry, that Wesley Foundation, we had that too. So we didn't always sing from the songbook. We also made our own illegal transparencies. Okay. But let's think. I'm trying to remember the date that Microsoft released PowerPoint. I want to say 93-ish. Sounds like that's about right.
Yeah, that's about right.
But worship designated projection software. So, and the precise details are in the book. Those will start coming out the late 90s period.
Mm-hmm. 1990.
Oh, for PowerPoint?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think also in the late 90s, the price of a projector went from about 80 grand to five or so.
Mm-hmm.
And so it became all of a sudden affordable.
Yeah, that's the amazing thing. Even as the technology advances in sophistication, the price point keeps dropping.
And laptop in 1990 was about $8,000.
Yeah.
And so that made a huge difference when it helped the price of the laptop went down too.
I was just curious to know if you've done any analysis of cost and availability of technology with its rise in usage.
Not in any precise sense, no. And it's something I want to get into because I really, if you think the list of scholars looking at the non-musical dimensions of contemporary worship is a short list, the list of scholars looking at the technological history of contemporary worship is a very short list. And there's virtually no secondary material on it. There are a couple of old dissertations, but I mean, it's the problem. You wrote a dissertation on the state of the question on technology and contemporary worship 10 years ago. How long is it before the dissertation itself is obsolete?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Somebody talked me out of writing my thesis on technology. So seriously.
Well, I mean, you just have to realize it's going to have a short shelf life
right.
in terms of trying to project ahead.
Yeah, no, I.
It still can be useful for projecting backwards. This is a major national conference now. A multi-day. Anybody been to the WFX conference, either regional or national? To the national one? So Sweet Hong and I are going this October. I've been to the regional one in Raleigh. And it's it's fun if you like technology and gizmos. But it's like, wow. And the reason why I think this is important, and I tried to make this point in the book, the technology has advanced to such a level that if you're fully invested in it, man, it's just amazing how you can manipulate your space and through the use of, it's radically changed the nature of music making. I mean, I'm trying to imagine Carl Tuttle playing with a click track. And how foreign that would be to that worship set that we heard on Symphony. And I even had to I made up a new word for the book, intemporaneous. You know, the concern with staying in time because of the ever-increasing management of time because the technology leads you there. I mean, some of y'all in large churches, is that not true? I mean, how tightly do you plan your service all the way through? You know, working on this book has answered a long-term question I've had for my favorite secular artist, Weird Al Yankovic. So for 30 years, I have gone to every Weird Al Yankovic concert that's any place close to me. And I'd go to these concerts, and I'd go, you know, it's really fascinating because I can see all the instruments on the stage. I'm hearing sounds that I don't see from the instruments. Yeah. How do they do that? Well, yeah, now I know about it. But and I just start thinking, that's amazing, the ability to create this musical world. And when you're using in-ear monitors and you're doing all the communication and stuff, this other world that actually exists within the worship space that the rank and file worshiper is not accessing and is not aware of. So I typically drive worshipers around me crazy when I go to a service because I'll spend a good bit of the time with my back towards the platform monitoring what's on the comfort monitor at the back because I just want to see what the service is like being experienced by the people on the platform. You know, and the rank and file worshiper never thinks about looking behind them in the service, but that's where you see that, visually see that other world that goes on. And when I was researching the book, I found enough churches in the Raleigh-Durham area, they were very, very kind. They let me embed myself in their production rooms. And the thing that I started noticing is in the more technologically advanced churches, how many clocks, and this whole management of time, I think is a significant development because of the technology or enabled by the technology. What is this?
We have 5 clocks.
You have 5 clocks?
Yes, sir. And I have to manage all of them.
Wow.
Yeah.
And again, compare that. I mean, let me just go. Where are my college students? Well, there are no clocks here. There's no clocks there. There are no clocks there. And I think, and I argue this in the book, it's actually created a little bit of tension because Pentecostal worship generally has reveled in the ability to be spontaneous, to respond to the immediate leading of the Spirit.
That's when you have a great data bank in your software and
yes.
You have a Spirit-led person running screens so that they can say, oh, that's where he's going.
Right.
And they're there in seconds.
But does it always work that way?
No, it doesn't.
It doesn't always work if that guy's absent.
So Mr. Vester,
yes,
we're having this argument, or actually discussion about the whole IMAG thing. You know, does IMAG really fit in theologically with worship? And I haven't come up with a good solution yet on that one, but seem to be that the bigger the venue becomes, IMAG becomes more important for
yeah,
the
I,
people.
I mean, potentially. Here's what I see as the upsides and downsides,
right,
okay?
Right.
So, modern forms of communication are based not just on the words, but on the ability to read body language and facial expressions. So in a large worship space, you don't have direct access to the facial expressions of the preacher. IMAG can give you that. Now, whether or not you need that same access for the vocalist is a different question.
Exactly.
And especially, and this is what these were the moments in the production rooms I grew up more concerned. It's when I, whoever was handling the video switching was directing the cameras to find images of worshipers in a particular state of worship. And that's that, because that's when I began to think, I hate to use the term manipulation, but... It's like, and you know, they would intentionally go scowling. Camera two, keep scanning. Oh, that person right there. Yeah. Oh. Yeah. Going camera two in three, yeah. Two, one.
Right. Wow.
It's like, why?
Because they're creating a what is a worship narrative, yes. That they're projecting from their ministry.
Yes, I mean, that's the fascinating thing to me. And I mean, just in terms of historical point, that's where we are now that we weren't even 15 to 20 years ago. So, I mean, you can see my point. I think the advancements, the number and rate of changes technologically is where the cutting edge of the contemporary worship is right now. And, I mean, that's even more than the musical changes that I see.
Hasn't this what we have now, all of this manipulation of the environment, manipulation of sound, of lighting, of whatever, hasn't this created an atmosphere of religious superstars that are on television, that are on magazines, they're in talk shows, and all of a sudden it seems like instead of Christ being glorified, you've got this is so-and-so's church.
I mean, perhaps. I mean, we'd love to hear from y'all. I do know there are more celebrity worship leaders right now.
Yeah. And ministers, too. They're big celebrities.
Yeah, but see, that happened for the preachers as soon as they began to be televised.
As soon as what?
They could be televised.
Oh, yeah.
And it's not just a Protestant thing. Who was the Catholic? Fulton Sheen?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was a big Roman Catholic TV presence right after World War II.
Mm-hmm. But today they can do so much more of it.
Yeah.
The way they can project, the way the angles of the camera, the lights, they can create this superstar.
Things. Yes, no.
But isn't that what we do in secular America? I mean, in the secular world? It's a cultural phenomenon that's throughout the whole world.
Yep.
I mean, so it's just religion just picks it up.
Well, and that was what I was trying to observe. And I would talk to some of the directors and the video switchers. I remember asking one guy, I asked him two questions. What's your education? What was your training to be able to do this job in the church? And he just has a degree in video production.
Exactly.
From UNC Wilmington, I think it was. And so I said, how do you know when to switch images? I mean, what determines how long it is you keep a particular image on, image magnification? And all of his values were drawn from the non-church world.
This, to me, this, I really don't want to grow into a curmudgeon, but and I don't.
Too late.
Yeah, too late. Thanks, brother. but you know, all of this, you know, I can even feel my blood pressure rising. But you know, it really does require pastoral and theological reflection on all these. I mean, one of the big things about IWS and with the callings and future, you know, renewal is cultural accommodation. This is cultural accommodation. Without I love the creativity of it and all that, but what gets to me, and I've worked in churches not this big, but where this, you gotta do this, you gotta do this, you gotta have IMAG, there's no reflection. Why are we doing this? Well, that's because that's what everybody's doing.
Yep.
There's really no reflection. It's an old book, you probably know it, but a book that is helpful is Quentin Schultz's book.
Yeah,
because he asks those questions. Now it's 2004, so it's way old, but he's asking those critical questions that we really need to ask.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's all bad. I'm really not. See, I'm not as curmudgeonly as you think, Dave.
No.
But we've got to, and I hear the questions being raised. The reflection questions, what does this mean? What is it doing? And you said it too. Has it really raised my radar when they're just starting to switch to manipulation? So that's, I think, I don't know who said it. Did I hear it? Yeah, I heard it in chapel today about being a one who's thankful, and the ten who and the nine who aren't. These are real important roles for us to play in thinking through and reflecting. Not that we don't necessarily do these things, but why?
And those are great questions, Bob. I mean, my initial task has been just to try to provide a good basic documentation and description. Pastorally, I would go to those sort of questions. And I've seen, if I slip out of historian mode into theologian, pastoral sort of mode, I have seen use of the very same technology that I would applaud, and then I would say I've seen uses of it that are more questionable. So for instance, this is environmental projection, in which you're not even worried about the screens. You're essentially, you've got the entire front graphed by computer, and you can do different images. We could turn these speakers any distinct color that we wanted to. You know, this could become a medieval cathedral up here. It could become an urban landscape. Here, I think this is actually facilitating, if I had...
Yeah.
Because surely this is a song about the names of God.
Right.
And so they're just overpowering you with the visual image of that.
Right.
And it's like... So the use of it actually reinforces it. But I've seen environmental projection used just to be cool and novel. It's like, oh, I've never seen that before.
We just need to ask questions.
This fellow's had his hand up for quite a while.
I was just wondering, I know that we can manipulate technology to enhance our worship experience and to enhance worship in the space. And I'm thinking about where it works against us and we become disconnected by it. For example, at our university, we've gone from using monitors to using inner ears.
Yes.
And to enhance the quality. Also, we have pitch benders so that we can bend our pitch so that we're perfectly in pitch. But when I put those inner ears in for the first time, I felt so disconnected from the body. And yes, I can hear what people are doing, but I still can't get over this hump. And I keep thinking, yes, this is supposed to enhance the worship experience, but me, the worship leader, I feel completely disconnected from you people right in front of me. How do I navigate that? How do I negotiate?
I really don't know. And I think it could get even worse because depending on what the lighting is in the space, if they're using strong theater platform sort of lighting, where you're inundated in strong lights, and the house is completely dark, and you can't see the people at all. So you're cut off from them in terms of sound, and you're cut off from them in terms of sight.
You think the picture of John Wimber sitting at the at his keyboard, and he's watching prayer groups. He's engaged. He's reading the group. He's reading the crowd, and he's very much a part of that, or whoever.
Yes.
And I feel like there's this, we're developing these walls. Not necessarily. This is how my question.
I wish I could give you a good answer on how to navigate it. My own thinking, my own experience is not the best. I mean, I would welcome anybody else who would want to try to answer the question.
I'm going to be the real curmudgeon here. I'm right there with you. I was leading worship in a situation where it was like the lights are turned down. You know, I'm on stage and I'm leading worship to six locomotives. You know, that's what I see. And the room is black. And all I could read that I was really frustrated. And the people were really frustrated too. And to me, this value in me is just so ingrained. And I guess I don't want to say do it like I do, but you have to figure out what is it that's really important. Because obviously you've got a concern about I'm feeling separated from the people I'm leading. To me, that would drive me nuts. And that's what it did in that case. And I wound up telling the sound guy to mute my guitar, I unplugged it. And walked out and up and down the aisles, and I said, "Let's just sing Here I Am to Worship." And that's what we did, and it was pretty powerful. But the point, I guess, as I'm saying, when you get to where you're feeling uncomfortable with, I'm not connected, are they feeling we're not connected? Mm-hmm. It's the question to ask. You know, are we, again, I relate again to the vineyard. That's my background. Again, you always think the older you get, the better it was. To me, I like the idea. It's a high value for me that we're going there together. We're going there together. And if we're not going there together, then I go, it's a broken. That's a question you got to ask, I guess.
Yes, Luke.
In principle, this is no different than privileging the pipes of a pipe organ for a well-strapped choir in Mansion Groves. And there's something that's before the congregation that they're seeing that's serving a mediatorial role. It could be the altar, it could be the pulpit, but in this case, it's the worship leader that's serving that role.
There are upsides and downsides to that.
Yeah, and I'm implying a downside to it.
Yeah. Yes.
Two things, going to kind of echo that. You know, at some point, stained glass was new technology. And printed Bibles was new technology.
Yeah.
Printed hymnals was new technology. There's a really excellent book that kind of asks a lot of these questions specifically about technology and worship called From the Garden to the City by John Dyer. And I think it's part of his post-grad work.
Oh, okay.
It's really good.
From the
garden to the city.
Okay.
And it tracks the idea there is from the Garden of Eden to the city.
And I hope y'all are not hearing me just objecting to the use of all technology. I mean, I'm still trying to wrap my mind around what are these things and what can they do and how are they being used. Were there other hands up?
Yeah.
Were you finished?
No.
I'm sorry.
The church has always been reacting to and adapting to and incorporating the new technology of the day. And it's a fairly new phenomenon that the cutting edge technology is developing outside of the church.
Yeah.
You know, the printing press is a perfect example.
So what's your response when I'm talking to the AV consultants and the sales representatives, and their standard argumentation on why this is necessary is because people are growing used to certain levels of handling of sight and sound outside the church, and if they come to worship and they see something not as sophisticated, worship won't be attractive to them, it will be repelling to them, it will strike them as an activity that we're not valuing. Is there value in that argument? Is there truth in that argument?
I don't know. For me, I think it, the sales literature of the technology of the day can't be the driver. It's a theological question. And so if you start from a place of theology and incorporate new means and methods and holding the methods and means with an open hand and fit new things, then that's fine. But if you jump in with no thought to the ramifications and effects that new technology is going to have, that's where you get in trouble.
Yeah.
And I think that the pervasive thought that we've just grown accustomed to is just that.
Yeah.
It's not one that's a careful word.
I forgot who it was over here. I think they've already left. They were telling me their church, fairly new church plant, is intentionally low-key. It was in a courtroom. Acoustic. So they were telling me when their acoustic bass player left, someone else intentionally went and bought an acoustic bass and learned how to play it to be the substitute. And so I said, who's coming to your church? And they said, millennials. So it may be, interestingly,
pendulum swinging.
Yeah, but one of the things I'm always objecting to, both in spoken presentations to me and in the literature, are overgeneralizations about generations. that all millennials are like this. All baby boomers are like this. Let me keep pressing on because we're running out of time. I just wanted to show these two pictures. These are, if you've never been inside a worship production room, this is what it looks like. And typically you find someone who's operating the video switcher here, and then someone operating the computer graphics here. This is the picture that ended up in the book. This is the picture I actually wanted to put in the book because I took it. But we could never get the permission from the church to include the picture. So these are technological impacts, I think. Some of these I've already mentioned. Closer management of time. The whole fluidity of space. The whole development of remote campuses. I mean, that's a new development that essentially you could have multiple campuses linked, usually by the server. Either live streamed or delayed or brought over by tape. The reshaping of church staffing, of worship-related staffing. I mean, how many churches had dedicated positions to technological development 30 years ago, and how many of them have it now? The reshaping of the ritual model upon which worship is based. The thing that strikes me, just as kind of, well, I'm an observer, but I'm an investment observer. It's really striking me. I think the technology is bringing concert ritual forms more and more to the church. How do you shape the space? How do you shape the experience? What's the type of behavior?
It's the conversations that happen almost weekly.
Yes. And even the ongoing, it was really fun to talk to worship leaders and just ask them if they're performing or not. Because they know they're not supposed to say yes. Right? But everything about the ritual form says you are. And I just wonder how many thousands of worship leaders are deeply conflicted every Sunday about, I'm not performing, yes I am performing. And you know, and the technology just won't let them escape that question. Does that make sense? Does that seem a fair observation?
So is there a corollary, Lester, with, there's a perception that I'm picking up on here. This is only possible because of privileged affluence.
And privilege?
Privileged affluence.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Okay, but there are many, many faith communities within our country who are not affluent, and certainly around the world.
Yeah.
So to some extent, this might go south really fast if we all, you know, if our collective economies crash to the extent that we don't have that exposure.
I mean, I don't know. I'm sure the Holy Spirit will figure out something. But, I worry about this, even as we were talking today, since contemporary worshiping churches around the world often look to both American, British, and Australian models. How are we not subtly sending the message that this is the particular form that you need to adopt, including the technological aspects of it? I don't know. And there's the whole social justice question here. I mean, one of the reasons I like to look at the technology is because as I visit a range of churches, it's the width of the range of available technology that I see some of the biggest differences in. The one church with the line drawing I put in the book on is Hillsboro United Methodist Church. I intentionally put that line drawing in there because they've had a contemporary worship service for about 15, 16 years now. Their building is pre-American Civil War. Mm-hmm. And it's the same space they use for their traditional service. So when it comes time for their contemporary service, the only thing they do is they bring in a portable stand, and then they bring in the portable projector, and they hook it up to a laptop. And what their contemporary worship has done overall in the space is they removed pews from their choir loft. It's a side choir loft. And they have flexible seating in there now, so it's easy to make the transition between the two services. You know, I mean, that's about as low-key technologically that I see a contemporary service. But the quality of the musicianship, even for a small church, especially for a small church, is really high. You know, so that's not where the biggest difference is. It's actually in the technology. Let me keep pressing on, because we're running out of time, and y'all are getting tired. I don't know why in the world I put this up here, other than just demonstrate concert control. I took this picture again. This is Passion City Church in Atlanta. And then there have been major impacts, and we won't discuss this because it's in the book, and hopefully you have at least a bookmark. So hold the bookmark up your forehead and osmosis. So let me, if you've had me for the 701 course here, you know I always talk about upsides and downsides. So let me do that for just a moment. And this is not a long presentation because my thought's still in process. But I would like to know what you have seen as the upsides and the downsides of this whole history of contemporary worship. We just got through naming some. Anything else strike you about this whole development over 50 years? Yes?
I'd like to go back to Rob's question about monitors and being disconnected. So I belong to a worship ministry blog on LinkedIn, and there was a question about something about in-ear monitors, and I decided to jump into the conversation, and I said, so how do you feel it impacts your ability to actually hear the congregation, or how do you know what the congregation is doing? And the discussion after my question was all technologically based. Nobody said anything about feeling like they needed to hear the congregation or wanted to hear the congregation. It was really interesting.
That is interesting. So,
I mean, I don't think it's an easy answer. I think, you know, taking one out so that you can hear something acoustically, or does the lead singer person need to hear everybody on stage, or can you listen acoustically and still hear the congregation?
I mean, I don't know. That's still the embedding that I want. I'm still trying to find a church that will let me embed myself in the worship band.
Yeah.
Tambourine.
Just you can take all the jingles off of it so it doesn't make any sound. Just let me get up there on the stage and give me an ear monitor so I can actually experience it. Yes.
One of the ways to connect, and I work at Indiana Wesleyan University, and our chapel service three times a week. Anyway, we have Abby, and so we're kind of noise-reducing headphone, you know, or earbuds or whatever. So we're trying to isolate sound. I know, all the technical jargon, they kind of throw at me as well. I'm a person that loves to pop one out just like I can hear. And to accommodate that, they have a microphone that's supposed to pick up some of the ambient sound, right, you know, yeah, ambient mic, room mic. But with me, there's two issues. One, I don't want to be so focused on my team. We should have either rehearsed or know each other well enough to play, so I'm not so hyper-focused on, like I'm in a recording studio, what it feels like. But I want us to be, to flow in the music, but also be attentive. Prepare like everything, I don't know where I heard this from. Prepare like everything depends on me, but worship is that everything depends on God. I love that quote for many ways. It's not necessarily theologically sound, but it gives us a chance to not feel so tied into the technology, but just use it as a conduit for what we're doing. And I think secondly, the narrative, the answer to something you said earlier about when you say to the tech people that says, you know, to, you know, look or sound like they expect something. Well, we don't have the same narrative that the concerts that we attend have. The narrative changes, or should change, the technology and our use of technology. Not that we push away from it necessarily, but embrace it so it can, you know, tell the great narrative.
Yeah, but that takes some intentionality and reflection, doesn't it?
Exactly.
We've lost the choir. Oh, you lost the choir.
No, I mean, I've been in the church.
Yeah.
Not where I'm at, but we were transitioning to contemporary worship, and so we lost the choir. Which, you know, about 60 people that were involved in the choir.
I mean, that's interesting. I have seen on rare occasions contemporary services that had choirs in.
Les, have you done any research with Brooklyn Tap and how they, they go for contemporary, yeah. but with a choir?
Yeah. No, I haven't. I mean, I hope y'all realize, by no means am I trying to say that what I've done, this book or what I'm about to, has exhausted everything that can be looked at and should be looked at. So no, I haven't gotten into that.
Different stream. It really is a different stream. Yeah. That urban gospel is a different stream. One thing that I would say, and I'll make it real quick, is, and you mentioned it in your book, and you've talked about it a little bit, but I think one of the greatest gifts of this is the sacramentality of this actual engaging with God through this genre. I think it's one of the greatest gifts to the church. And we're a church, and you mentioned in your book, where churches, they don't really quite get us because they don't get that sacramental aspect. Here's this gift thing, which I subscribe to, or is it gap thing? Mm-hmm. People who subscribe to gap just don't quite fully get it. And I think you said that's where you have most of your worship wars. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you have people in the same church that they really believe it's a gift, and they understand it's a gift because they get the sacramental aspect, because they engage with God through that. And over here, it's, well, that's just another musical genre. And that's where the disconnect is. But that, to me, is... To me, it's the greatest gift of the genre of the last 40 years.
Mm-hmm. And his hand was up first, Bill, right? I think.
Yes. So I just think years ago we used the derogatory term song leader, right? And the person in front was a song leader. And then going to IWS, we learned the term worship pastor. Constance Cherry, 702. We
spent pastoral musician.
Pastoral musician, right. Where the leader is like a Carl Tuttle, where he's up there, he's sensing the spirit as he moves. Now I wonder if we're not getting back to song leader again. We've got our in-ear monitors that separate us from the congregation. We've rehearsed this set down to the half minute. And I just wonder if we're shifting back now to song leader. We've got our songs, and how sensitive are we, as Carl was, to the moving of the spirit in that moment?
You know, what you just said mimics what Dick Iverson, the retired pastor from Bible Temple, Portland, Oregon, one of those key Latter-day churches, just told me about his perception of where things had gone. Wow. That all of this early gift from God was restoring worship back to the people. And now he's afraid of, what has to be called, platform worship.
Yeah.
That's all the worship is up on the platform being observed by people. And it was really interesting, you know, hearing this 88-year-old man who had been instrumental in the 60s and 70s telling me that.
Okay.
Well, I'm trying to be fair to everyone who had their hands up, so yes.
Perhaps as a tag on to that, and by the way, the pastor once referred to me as the Tuneheister, so anything is better than that.
The Tuneheister?
Tuneheister. But I think maybe one of the places of both upside and then downside, and as a continuation of what my friend down there has shared, is the pastoral guidance through these things and having a pastoral intention about how and where we do these things is so incredibly important. So that, say, the technology is not the first question we ask, or repertoire, or instrumentation, or how many minutes do we get to spend. One of our colleagues, Ron Richardson, could do anything as he wanted as long as it was contained within 11 and a half minutes, right? So the pastoral process of walking through these things, no matter what style, is really the most important thing.
Yeah. Thank you.
I compare it to what he said to the history of the communion, when the table moved to the back and the wall came up, and eventually it had to come back down back to the
table. Not to get hung up on the technology side, but recently wondered if there isn't a downside to, we talked about the manipulation factor, the lights and the sound and the creation of space, you know, like we are trying to steward the space and create an environment where people can feel comfortable to encounter God, but in a planning meeting for a special service recently, two of the, well, there are a couple that was helping plan it, my age, a little younger, said, you know, about our space, we have these big windows, we have shutters, you know, it kind of helps dim the light a bit, but it's a lot of natural light, it's a light space. And they said, you know, well, we're really used to and like when we're in bigger spaces that are darker and it's more intimate, it's just me and God. And it makes me wonder if we're not creating a dependency on environment to experience God. So, you know, can you worship in someone's front room or in a less technological church? Or do you need now, have you gotten so used to that heightened level, that concert atmosphere, that I can't worship if I don't have XYZ, if I can't ignore my neighbor and be in the zone with God, if I can't, you know, if I can't blank, is there a dependency?
I would love to get their reaction to that videotape of Ken Galton's church there on the beach for a year. Yeah. Let me go through my own list real quick, so I feel like I'm earning my money, if you don't mind. I started thinking, the language did need to change. You know, and I think the fact that of everything that we've talked about, that's probably been the least controversial topic that's come up in the last few days. Immediacy of the music and accessibility of the services have brought about many new Christians. I think we can't deny the fact that the rise of this new form of worship has meant not only the world, but eternity for countless thousands, me included. I think it's reinvigorated congregational singing. And I think the reestablishment of praise as a central liturgical act was a major contribution. Because if you take a look at classic liturgical forms over 2,000 years, when Christians didn't know what else to do in a service, they reverted, the default setting was revert to praise. And so that emphasis, I think, is very, very important. And then there's an interesting sort of both ecumenical and global connections. I mean, it's quite striking. I was in, where was I? El Salvador last December teaching Methodist pastors down there. And they started worshiping. I knew exactly what they did. You know, notwithstanding the fact that the specifics of the lyrics were largely inaccessible to me, I knew exactly what to expect, I knew exactly how to participate, you know, and it would be reciprocal if they came here. So, downsides. I think, and we haven't talked about this, I think the reduction of the word worship to music is a downside.
Yep.
There are times when I hesitate to tell people I'm a worship professor because then the next question is, well, what instrument do you specialize in?
Tambourine.
And when I say tambourine, I play djembe and congas in a small praise team for 8 years before moving to North Carolina. Okay. A very acoustic sort of environment that we were doing. Or even perhaps more problematic is what I hear sometimes, worship equals mood, which is the downside to this whole Thanksgiving to praise to worship sort of thing, where worship, you know, in that ritual Latter Rain teaching is action, but it's so closely tied to how do you assess when you're actually there and you're assessing God's. You know, so I've had students talk to me about, I don't really like a service until I can get into a worship group. And as a church historian, you know, if you try to apply that category across 2,000 years, it's like, that doesn't make sense to the vast majority of Christians who've ever existed. This privatization of worship, the concert lines, and we, but the whole ability to access worship music through iPods, MP3 players, CD players, you know, so that there's advertising, you get in your car to worship. And, you know, and so there's a potential privatization there. The taking away congregational singing, we've already mentioned that. The diminished prayer diet. And that came up a little bit when I was doing my song assessment. If y'all don't want to type this out, these are all available on my
Elbury website. Diminished scriptural diet. I mean, I've noticed just in what I've presented and what we've talked about, the whole question about how many scriptures can you read, which scriptures do you read, what do you preach on? You know, what contemporary worship has meant in terms of our use of the Bible is a, I think, is a potential downside and is often an overlooked topic. The marginalization of pastor as worship leader. I mean, I have a favorite story. At Asbury, I was teaching my history of Christian worship class once. And about 3 weeks into the course, a student came up to me and said, "Ah, Dr. Ruth, I'm finally getting what you're saying." Well, I said, "Well, Fred, what was it?" He says, "You're telling me the pastor is a kind of worship leader too." Again, thinking 2,000 years, just that was novel to that student would have struck virtually all Christians for 2,000 years. Mm-hmm. Is that, where in the world did that guy get that opinion? Mm-hmm. You know? And this even works. Does the pastor have to be in the space for the entire service? I mean, if I was still pastoring, as a matter of conscience, that would be something that I would insist upon for myself. I can't just show up in time and give the sermon. And conversely, I wouldn't dismiss the musicians to go back to the green room after the set's over. This reinforced hyper-Christocentrism, and then let me, you know, you paid good money to be here, so let me throw in some fancy words. So this hyper-Christocentrism, I mean, this phenomenon really does strongly, devotionally attach to Jesus. So this is a new word, patri superfluidity, which is the superfluousness of the Father. And so pneuma superfluidity is the superfluousness of the Holy Spirit in the actual content of worship. Yeah.
Lester, yeah. Torrance says something about this, doesn't he?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
We've sort of become Unitarian in the way we worship.
Oh, we're functionally Unitarian, right. Is his phrase. Functionally Unitarian.
Interesting.
Yeah. And again, if you'll remember my exercise, and it's a really useful one for students, have them read the book of Romans, a chapter a day for 16 days, first 16 days of the semester, and just have them note the God-naming practices that Paul uses in the book of Romans. And then they will realize you can't talk about the saving work of Christ apart from talking about God the Father and the Holy Spirit, if you want to do it in apostolic way. And then the commercial industries potentially not considering what's good for the church. And the commercial industrialization really, I mean, it started early, but especially it's gained steam in the last 20 years or so. I mean, I think some of us were even talking with CCLI being sold. You know, well, whoever's directing that whole enterprise now be operating with a commitment to welfare and the life of the church. And then finally, the loss of patience is a desirable virtue in worship, in worshipers. And part of that's the consumerism of our age and how certain forms of contemporary worship play into that. Part of it's the subtle spiritual formation that takes place in the actual content. But, you know, do our ways of worship actually teach worshipers that you may have to delay desire and you may have to delay fulfillment? And you may have to delay satisfying yourself in order to do a way of worship that's best for your neighbor. This will be the concluding word. There's a Roman Catholic ethicist. He's actually a friend of mine, James Cacamo. He's a moral theologian. He's an ethicist who specializes in worship music.
And so he wrote his dissertation and has written some articles. What's the best kind of worship music? It's the worship music that helps my neighbor worship. And I'm afraid the whole phenomenon at its worst doesn't instill that sort of attitude. So, y'all have been wonderful. I really appreciate y'all coming to this. It's been great to share with you, to sing, to play, to hear your stories. I hope we will stay in contact, especially if you have historic resources that you might be interested to help tell this story. I'm being quite honest with that. I mean, I'm looking for written documentation, and audio and video files of especially worship from the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. But anyway, thank you so very much.
Thank you. God bless you.
Lord God, you are always more gracious to us than we would ever deserve. And we sense, even in the hiccups of this entire phenomenon, your hand has been there. Your spirit has been blowing. And you have brought about good things. How we would ask that you would take us, both collectively and each of us individually, those of us still here and those of us who had to leave early, use us for your good purposes. Restore the glory of your name through the work that you can accomplish through us. And open our mouths, Lord, like the psalmist says, so that we might indeed proclaim your praise. This we would sincerely ask for. And thank you for your time and leadership of our time together. This we would do, pray to you through your Son, Jesus Christ. Amen.